everyone. Thanks for tuning into the Message podcast of Friends Church. My name is Alessandra. I'm one of the team members here, and we're so glad that you're joining us. It's been really encouraging to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening in. We really hope that our messages are resonating with you. We also wanted to say thank you to those who are contributing to Friends Church. All of the things we're able to do, it's because of people who donate regularly. Even small, consistent gifts help a lot. If you haven't had the chance yet to give, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that, especially if it's been beneficial in your own journey. To do that, it's really easy. Just go to our website, friendschurch.ca, and click on the Donate tab, or download our Friends Church app and click on the Give tab. Thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy this week's message.
Welcome everybody again, everyone who's online, who's going to hear me in 6 months from now on a podcast, welcome. It's a bit odd to have that kind of a time lag, isn't it? Today we're going to do something a little bit different. The world is opening up in a way that after the last 3 months feels a bit crazy, doesn't it? Right now, we have our offices downstairs. If you kind of go through the maze of the building, down underneath there is our offices. And we actually have a full kids' day camp running during the week. So after 3 months of lockdown, it's a bit crazy to see like massive groups of kids together and singing and doing performances together. But that's where we are in this world right now. And so Tara is our new kids' ministry director. And I wanted her to come and just kind of talk a bit about what the future of Kids at Friends looks like. Now, some of you here, you're kind of the first ones who are open to coming back to a physical place. But it's fascinating. As we've talked the last little while, kids seem to need like a real person interaction in a way that maybe adults don't.
Yeah. So Vince and I, on that note, were talking the other day about my daughter, Jordana.
Okay, you have two kids, right?
Two kids.
Youngest?
I have Easton, who's 7, and Jordana, who's 10.
Okay, for the people like me who don't have kids,
yeah,
like,
sorry.
How big is that? Like, Jordana's about that big?
Jordana's about that big. Well, she's quite tall, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and so she had a birthday.
Yeah, so her birthday, she was turning 10, kind of right in the thick of the lockdown.
Brutal.
And so Vince and I were chatting about what that looked like for me, trying to plan something to make it special, especially transitioning to double digits. So I decided to get a bunch of huge helium balloons, and I set them out in a circle 6 feet apart and had spots where the little girls could come and sit to visit, have a cupcake together, and sort of sing happy birthday to my daughter. Mm. And through that, I really saw how important it was for those girls to reconnect and have that face-to-face time.
And didn't you say, like, your daughter's been talking about that, like, long after the...
Oh, yeah. That really energized her. I thought that I was doing a great job keeping her entertained at home. But apparently she needed to be around kids,
right,
her own age. And I also noticed the parents who were dropping off to this socially distanced little park party were lingering to say hi to each other and have a catch-up. And I just really made me realize how much I think parents and kids are longing for that connection still,
yeah,
and are missing out at this stage with the lockdown and things being not as easy to be with others.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it kind of sparked that conversation with Vince about bringing kids in back into Friends. And
what does that look like? Yeah.
What does that look like? Yeah.
Now, the government has a whole set of rules. Now, they opened us up a couple weeks ago to do day camps and stuff like that, but we've kind of held off just trying to figure out how to do this safely. So how have you come up with a way to bring kids back in a way that is safe for them and
right,
for Friends Church and for everybody?
Well, I think that birthday party was a good starting point to sort of understand what that would look like having,
yeah,
kids together.
Totally.
And so after a lot of consideration, because I wanted to make sure we're doing this right,
yeah,
we decided that a small cohort of kids,
okay,
ages grade 3 to 5,
okay,
would be our starting point for bringing kids back. And our strategy is to sort of start really small and go from there and build a framework on what works and what doesn't. And but I'm really confident that we've worked hard to have all the protocols in place to make
right,
it a safe place to come. And
So the entry and exit will kind of look a little different, still downstairs, but instead of those little classrooms, you're going to have like a mega classroom, right?
Yeah, we have three classrooms all open together.
Right.
And the idea actually is to launch during summer, where my plan is to have them outside as much as possible.
Fantastic.
So I can have, they'll have a lot more fun in the sun and actually have the space to maneuver safely.
Totally. Now, why now? Why, like, what is it the thing... Yeah, what is it in you that's like, no, this is important for us?
Well, I really think that for kids, having a sense of connection and security, whether it's with family or teachers or friends, community, is really important to their development. And also to sort of surviving this pandemic and coming out on the other end of it. So I'm excited to have a place, a really fun space for them to come and work on their spirituality and try and make their world a little bit better.
Totally.
Well, yeah.
And again, we don't do this for the parents, but the parents may be having an hour to work on their spirituality, aka sleep, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Vince asked me, how has your self-care looked? And I said, well, does sleep count? Because that's about as much self-care I'm having lately. But yeah, we had the conversation about what it looks like for parents to be able to come also and just have that 1 hour of their own self-care.
Yeah.
And know that their kids are having fun and engaging their spirituality as well. So I think it's open to parents to make that decision on their needs as well as what
totally.
The kids need.
So for the parents who want to sign up their kids, what's the next step for them?
So you can, I've reached out to the email contacts that I have and
right.
sent that out, but I also, there's a link on the friendschurch.ca website under kids.
So just friendschurch.ca/kids. Fantastic.
Yep.
And they can sign up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have to track all their information just like we do here.
Yep.
But again, for those people who are interested in having their kids grow their spirituality, this is a great step.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
I'm very excited. Yeah.
You're going to be fantastic. Thank you
very much
for coming, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Got to stand on the X. Welcome, all of you here and all of you there. My name is Vince. I get to talk about charitable giving. But I want to ask you this question first. What'd you do last week? And how hard is it to remember? So I'm going to ask it differently. What did you do that was worthwhile last week? What was worthwhile? When I ask myself that question, what did I do? I can get lost in all sorts of rabbit holes, but I don't know where I'm going. But when I think of what was worthwhile, it's immediate. So yesterday we did this beautiful hike out in Kananaskis. And as I was sitting in my chair, wondering, okay, you know, here's my opportunity to, number one, thank you for your charitable giving. Number two, for all those on pre-authorized giving from a business perspective, oh my goodness, does it ever help with scheduling and predictability, which is what every business, especially right now, needs. And to thank you for that. So why do I contribute? Because Friends Church is worthwhile. I don't do church. It's something that's incredibly worthwhile. It addresses, as I'm sitting here, everything, and I was writing in my journal, all my basic fundamental needs are met right here in this room that are different when I watch online. Love, connection, growth. And that's what makes Friends Church worthwhile. That's why I contribute. And so to all of you who contribute, I'm certain that there is some sort of fundamental need that is being met, which is behind the pen that writes the check or the thumbs in the push pay or what have you. So as you go into the week, think of, and someone says, hey, what did you do? You know, how was your week? What did you do? Translate that immediately into what did you do that was worthwhile? And I'd love to hear the answer. Not personally, like you can't have my email address because I think that's confidential. But thank you very much. I was talking to Vince Pryor and he just said, you know, we sent out the black box is absent for those watching online. Like there's this black box that we used to dump our stuff into. It's gone. It's part of the COVID rules. We can't have black boxes. If we had a white box, it'd be different. But black boxes are disallowed. So we've been talking about contributing, and he said, you know, Friends Church is doing really well. And that's because I believe, for me, for you, this place is worthwhile. So thank you.
His email is actually Vince is the best Latverse name ever at gmail.com, so please send him an email. It's fine. I have a confession to make. Easter this year, feels like it's 10 years ago, you know, we had 280 people in here. It was like crazy. Sorry, no, that was Easter 2 years ago. Oh my goodness. You can tell how our weeks have been, right? This year, Easter was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And so we're trying to figure out a way to do something that would connect you. And so I had this idea. I was like, what if we tell the Easter story? And then Jeff was like, well, what if we got people to record it in different places? We'll put it all together and it'll be super sexy. And it was, right? Anyone see that? Anyone? Just lie to me and put your hand up. It's okay. It was beautiful. I'm going to show you again so you guys can see it. But there's an itty-bitty little problem. I wrote the script. Jeff went through the script after. We got the actors together. They recorded, did a great job. Then Gregory came together and put it together, this beautiful video. And at the end, I realized I missed a really, really, really key part of this. But I want you guys to see if you can catch it. So I'm just going to have multimedia play the video for me, and I'll come back.
It started in a manger. There was no place for him at the inn. Strangers had showed up to see what had come. The boy, Jesus, who's named after his ancestor Joshua, meaning one who saves.
For 30 years, his life was unremarkable. And then, at a wedding reception that had run out of wine, something special happened. Jesus, now a man, stepped into something more, a rabbi, a teacher, a savior.
The next 3 years are a flurry of activity, teaching, healing, making the world a better place. And then there's a misstep, a political misstep, and Jesus is arrested for crimes against the tradition. Ultimately, he's arrested for crimes against power.
That is where the Easter story begins, in a garden with Jesus and his students, one man betrayed with a kiss, his students stepping up to defend, but Jesus calms them, and so he's arrested. My way is not violence.
The trial starts with the authorities of tradition. You aren't doing this right, they accuse. To which Jesus poses a question. The answer is not to their liking. But they didn't like it from the beginning. But Jesus defends no more. My way is not violence.
The religious authorities turn Jesus over to power, to the leader of the day, Pilate, who inquires, "Are you a threat to my power?" To which he replies, "I never said that I was."
And so Pilate stops caring. But the people won't have it. They've already made their decision. Death is the only answer. But Jesus says, "No more. My way is not violence."
Pilate has Jesus tortured, treated like the treasonous, tearing his body to shreds, shaming him publicly, and trying to destroy him, mind, body, and soul. Still, Jesus is silent. My way is not violence.
They nail his hands and feet to a wooden cross, pulling it up vertically, the most painful way they could devise. And as Jesus hangs there dying, he turns to his tormentors and says,
"I forgive you. Violence is not my way." And so he dies. But something of Jesus lives on after his death. Something that spoke to the people that knew him. Something that speaks to us. Something that inspires us.
This calls us to something more. To be something more. And to take up his call.
For something in the way the Easter story goes strikes something inside so many of us.
asking us to explore, you know, what are we willing to live for? What are we living for? What are we willing to die for?
Could it be that that silent mantra resonates in our hearts? Which is why today on Easter Sunday, we say together, my way is not violence. Amen.
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 Really beautiful video, wasn't it? I'm backstage and I'm feeling myself get emotional with it. It's beautiful, this line, like, my way is not violence. And from a pacifist Mennonite background, that sounds really good. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was looking at the production, I was looking at the people and going, oh, this is beautiful. And then I remembered this one story that kind of messed it all up for me. I'll tell you the story in a second, but first, I want to show you some artist renderings of the story. Austin, can you throw the first one up for me? Jesus is in the middle. Notice what's going on with his hand. Can you go to the next one? This shows it a little bit more obvious, huh? My way is not violence. Can you do the next one? In this case, Jesus is in the far left corner. He's got a whip in his hand. Next one, please. Again. One more. This is one of the earliest ones we have. Again, you notice Jesus' posture. Hand raised in violence. Can you show me the last one? Looks like he's about to whip an old lady. Like, come on. My way is not violence? Is anybody seeing a problem between that beautiful, gorgeous video and the pictures I just showed you? The story reads that Jesus is walking around one day and he walks into what would be like the parking lot of Friends Church. Just wait for the siren to go by. They're saving lives. They're more important than I am. So he walks out to a church, and essentially what would be in the church parking lot, there's a bunch of people selling stuff. Maybe today it would be like they're selling masks for you to be able to walk in if you wanted to wear a mask. It's something that makes sense in the context of what's going on, but Jesus sees it and loses it. All the way through the stories of Jesus, we see these moments where, you know, violence has happened, he stops it. Someone tries to arrest him. One of his students tries to attack him. He stops him. Whoa, 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 whoa. It's not what we do. My way is not violence. But try and sell stuff in the church parking lot? Oh, sweet Jesus. He is going to lose his mind. He, like, the way he describes it is he takes a bunch of cords and makes it into a whip. I told Jeff about this story. He's like, yeah, but he didn't hit anybody. God bless you, Jeff. Right? Because in Jeff's mind, it's like, no, 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 that can't be. My way's not violence. That's Jesus, right? And yet, the images we see, it's all his hands raised in violence. So how do we go from, like, most of the text is my way's not violence to, yeah, but sell stuff in the church parking lot, I will lose it on you. How does that happen? And how, if you're thinking about it, is this going to connect to stranger danger? Bear with me. I'll get you there. The book we're basing this series on is called Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. Fantastic book, well worth the read. But in it, he tells a story about Sylvia Plath. Born in 1932, she's a poet, a short story writer, and a tragic, tragic figure. You see, 30 years after her life starts, she's living in England. Her maid, they just hired a maid for her. And the maid's trying to get into her apartment where she's living with two young kids. And she can't get in. Finally, the maid goes and gets the landlord. They open the door and they find Sylvia in her kitchen. She's got the oven door open and her head's inside. And she's dead. She's taped all the doors shut and stuffed towels underneath everything in the kitchen so that none of what's going on inside the kitchen will be seen by her kids sleeping just down the hall. You see, she struggled her whole life with chronic mental illness. And she had an almost, she's a writer, so she writes beautifully. And we can actually watch her mind unfold. And we see this kind of romantic attachment to what's called town gas. Back in those days, just before 1960, England used what they called town gas. That's how they fueled their stoves. And the difference between town gas and what we use now is town gas has an extremely high carbon monoxide content. Extremely high. Nowadays, when I turn on my oven, if I haven't lit it, I smell natural gas, right? In those days, you would smell nothing, and you would go to sleep, and you would never wake up again. It was efficient. It was painless. And in a sense that I'll explain, it was beautiful. People who died by town gas looked like they just went to sleep and didn't wake up. There's none of the gore of shooting oneself or jumping off something high. There's none of the pain of, you know, jumping off of a bridge. There was none of the risk of taking drugs and maybe having the wrong amount and living through that. None of that. You put your head in the oven and you go to sleep. And you never wake up. She was 30 years old when she ended her life. And something profound was happening right at that time in England that would have meaning for her life and her death. And ultimately will tie us back into why Jesus loses it when someone sells stuff in the parking lot. You see, in 1962, England started to change over the gas that they used to fuel homes. Town gas, remember, super high carbon monoxide content. They went to a lower carbon monoxide content. Not for those reasons. But ultimately, they changed the system. Now, if you look at Sylvia Plath, who wrote extensively about this idea of dying by town gas, of floating away on this kind of dreamy ending of her life, you would think that if you would remove the town gas from her life, what would happen? She clearly wants to kill herself. She's struggling profoundly with suicidal ideation. What do you think is going to happen? We take away her preferred method of doing it. What do you think? She's just going to find another way, right? Can you throw up that graph for me, Austin? What they saw after they removed town gas, and again, this was not the reason, but what they saw when they removed town gas is as they removed gas from England, the number of suicide dropped almost by the same amount. Again, it's not what we're thinking, is it, right? If I want to kill myself and you take away town gas, I'll find something else. But what they actually saw was that someone wanted to kill themselves, they took away their preferred method, and the person didn't do it then. If your brain's going like this, the idea in psychology is called coupling. One thing is coupled to another. They're not separate. Sylvia Plath's desire to die was coupled with town gas. Take away town gas, chances are we'd still have an amazing poet. I know, I've worked with people with suicidal ideation. Remove their preferred method of killing themselves. I remember one case, we removed the one method. They were just on the edge, and they knew they couldn't hold on if they had that means. We removed the means. There was drawers full of sharp knives. There was like a busy street right down the way. But as soon as we took away their preferred method, they were safe. because their idea of killing themselves was coupled to a certain means. Okay, let me do it a little bit different. Anyone's driven up 10th Street from downtown heading north, you go into Kensington. You know you go over the bridge onto Memorial. Do we all know that one? There's a building on your right as soon as you cross Memorial. It's a restaurant. What's the restaurant? For a while it was Greek. There was the Red Robins on the other side. Yeah, remember that one? The one on the other side, do you remember that one? Why don't we remember it? Because it's been like 13 different restaurants in the time I've lived in Calgary. You guys are nodding, right? I don't even try and remember the name anymore because I know in 6 months it won't be there. It's finally changed over to a cannabis shop, and the cannabis shop seems to be going quite well. But why is it that there's certain locations that when you see a restaurant going, you're like, oh, that's not going to be around for very long? Literally, if you go down the block, so you go down to 10th or to Kensington Ave, you go down a block, you find the Kensington Pub. Been there for over 25 years. Why is it that that location, no restaurant can survive, and yet a block and a half away, 25 years? How does that happen? It's because in our brains, we don't couple restaurant with that location. I can see you guys all kind of looking at me like, let me try one more. If you take 50% of all crime in a city and you map it down to a block, it shows up in somewhere between 2 and 5% of the city blocks. Let me say that again. Half of the crime shows up in less than 5% of the city. Here's the interesting thing. Right now, prostitution is illegal, right? If you have a block that is where prostitution happens, if the police go in there and clean it up, what do you think would happen in that block? If you were a prostitute and you were like, this is my business, what would you do? Well, I'm going to walk over a block and then start up again, right? But that's not what we find happening. What happens is criminals kind of go, oh, well, that's not working anymore, and they just stop altogether or they do something completely different. Because two blocks away isn't coupled with crime in their minds. That block is coupled with crime. And if you look through your life, think of all the different things that are coupled together. This goes with this. You take this out, this doesn't exist. Town gas, suicides drop. Clean up a block, it doesn't just go to the next block. It completely changes. There's certain locations that just don't make sense. You can't put a restaurant on the corner of 10th and Memorial. Like, if you do, come talk to me, and I'll be like, don't do it. You're wasting your money. It will not work. You can give away food there, and it won't work. Jesus walks up to a church, and there's merchants in the parking lot. What do you think he has coupled to that event? I don't know, but it's pretty sweet because he loses his mind. Now again, thank you, Jeff. He doesn't hit anyone with the whip, but he runs after them with a whip. The story actually doesn't tell us how he uses the whip, but it specifically says he wraps cords together to make a whip. Somehow in Jesus' mind, something is coupled to the experience of people selling stuff in the church parking lot. And his reaction is, he goes crazy. Now, why do I want to tell you this when we talk about stranger danger? So you guys all know my background. My background's in linguistics. The subset of what I studied is called hermeneutics. Funny word, it's Greek, whatever. Basically, it means this. How you go from text to meaning. And like all geeky things, there's a lot of different ways to do this. But when I read his thing on coupling, and I thought of Jesus in this event coupled in his brain, I went, how much of our world is coupled together through words? And then I went a step deeper and I went, wait a second. What experiences are coupled to words? I remember sitting in the teacher's office. And it wasn't for me for once. It was pretty cool. I was actually the teacher's aide. It was funny, though, even though I was the teacher's aide and I was supposed to be in the teacher's office, it still felt like I was in the teacher's office getting in trouble. That's an aside. I saw this moment of what we're talking about here play out just so beautifully. Not beautifully. It was disturbing, but it illustrated what I'm trying to get at. I'm sitting there, and I'm a teacher's aide, so it means I was hired to work with a little guy who had ADD. And for him, concentrating was so hard. He'd come up through the foster system. CFS had taken him away from his family. We're not exactly sure why, but man, that kid was skittish. You raise your hand a little bit too quick, he's jumping. You raise your voice, he's jumping. Every sense that I got was his past was not a safe one. And I've been called into the office with my guy because he got caught stealing from the teacher, him and somebody else. And here's the teacher, here's me, here's my guy, here's the little girl that's his accomplice. And the teacher says, if you don't tell me who started this, you're both getting punished. And I remember out of the corner of my eye seeing my guy. And his face just turned sheet white. I've never seen someone so terrified in my life. The little girl next to him was smiling. Somehow, and I don't know what it is, you know, my kid had been taken away from his family. There was boyfriends involved, we knew. He kind of dropped little stories. But I don't know, punishment for him meant something, was coupled to experiences that were different than hers. I don't know the experiences, but man, when she said the word punishment, he was so scared his face turned white. She was from a wealthy family. Her parents weren't super involved. She kind of run the show. I don't know. Punishment for her didn't even seem to faze her. Whatever experiences she coupled with that word punishment, completely different than him. How many experiences do we have coupled to words that shape the meaning of words for us, that make words complex? Yeah, we can look up in the dictionary what the word means, and that's true, but how many of our experiences color those meanings? Punishment for my guy wasn't, you know, to be disciplined for doing bad. It was something profoundly scary and threatening. For her, nothing. Punishment meant nothing. If you allow me, I'm just going to take a step out for a second. Talk in the same area. I don't know. So as we as a community, we have a lot of different subgroups in our community. And one of the subgroups we have in our community is the LGBTQ community. And so a bunch of them were in my book club this month, and I was asking them, hey, what word do you like? Like when I'm on stage, when I want to address your community, what word do you want me to use? And one person said, I said, well, like someone told me recently, queer is the word. And one's like, oh, no, don't use that word. The other one's like, no, I like that word. What are you talking about? So I said, okay, like homosexual? And one's like, well, technically that is it. But no, that one's horrible. That was the person who liked queer, didn't like that word. And we started going through this dance of words of like, I had two of them in the room, and they couldn't even agree on what word was coupled to negative experiences for them. Do you see it? I used to think, why can't you give us one word? And the reason you can't is because you have a community that's gone through a whole lot of pain. And you're trying to find a single word that has meaning to the community but isn't coupled to experiences of pain for any of them. Can you see how complex that task is? I used to get a little bit pissy after we got after, you know, 4, 5, 6 letters. I'd be like, oh, come on. I'm now going, how do you not have like 500 letters? Because words in and of themselves don't, that's not all the meaning there is. They seem to be coupled to experiences. And if you're sitting across the table from somebody, a stranger, someone you love, I don't care who it is, and you listen to their words alone, you will get screwed. I shouldn't say it that bluntly, but it's true. Because you're not seeing what the person's actually communicating. What they're saying, they might be using this core word, but often there's an experience underneath it that they're trying to communicate. And if we miss that experience, here's what happens. This actually happened to me this year. I was messed up for weeks on this one. It was with a professional. And I was working through some stuff, and I used a particular word. And she, God bless her soul, is doing her very best, and I don't have any hard feelings. But she looked at that word through her experiences. My experiences didn't match hers. And as she talked at me and dismissed that word and what she thought it meant to her, the experiences that were coupled to her, it was like she was just poking me with a stick. It was so bad that I walked away going, I will never, ever go back to someone like that again. Think about this. Let's just use a word that we all have, Father. What experiences are coupled to that word for you? Think for a second. Good father, bad father, bouncing you on your knee, you know, scared of them, loving, brutal. Were they alive, dead? Were they in your life? Were they absentee? The word father seems like, oh, that's a really easy word, right? We all know what that is. But think of all the experiences coupled to that word for you. Think of how loaded that word is. Now, let's do something else. Think of the person next to you or the last person you saw. And let's just imagine you walk up to them and you've had this big blow with your father. So you want to share your, you know, my dad, freaking son of a gun, did blah, 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 right? Can't believe it. He's always trying to control me. Sorry, Dad, that wasn't about you. Now, what if they just lost their dad? And they would give everything to have their dad back. How do you think they're going to respond to your feelings of my freaking dad said that freaking thing he always freaking says? He's driving me freaking nuts. Instead of hearing your experiences, what they're going to do is they're going to plop their experiences on top and say, well, at least you have a dad. How hurt do you feel right now? Right? You're like, screw you. I know I use the word father, but really what it is I'm trying to share my experiences that are coupled to that word with you. And to hear me, to know me, to love me, I need you to follow me through the words I use to my experiences. We're living in a time right now where we're having incredibly difficult conversations. The words we're using are being changed, are being adjusted. The experiences that we have that are tied to words and other people's experiences, we're realizing they're completely different. And yet I often hear people, and I do it myself, we're interacting on words. I was at a dinner party, and predominantly white, and there was one woman of color there. Great woman, super articulate. And we're talking, and it feels like this really casual place. And so I said, you know, hey, I've had this. A friend of mine brought up this issue for me. I got to try and figure out how this works. I said, if there's three women in this room, at the end of the dinner party, if I remember none of your names, but I want to address that I was talking to you, is it okay for me to say the black woman? Right? Three women, two of them are white, one's black. I want to identify the black woman. Is it okay that I say you're black? All of her friends kind of did this at the table, like, don't go there, Clausen. And I wasn't trying to poke the bear. Well, maybe a little bit poke the bear, but not really. To me, this is something that I wrestle with. And she went from this articulate, amazing woman to like stuttering. You can't. She was so upset by what I said. Why? It's true. If you take the experiences I have coupled to the word black, it's a color. It's simple. You have blonde hair, you have brown hair, you have red hair, black. It doesn't matter. It's just a color. Those are the experiences that I have coupled to that word. And in my ignorance, I assumed my experiences could apply to her. And yet, think about her. A black woman who always has to ask the question, is this happening to me because I'm black? Every experience of her life that's tied to color or that might be tied to color or that she felt was tied to color is in that moment when I say the black woman. Think of the amount of experiences that are coupled to that one word black for her. And I said, it's just a word. And I think we were both in a beautiful place, she would say, oh, it's not just a word, Vince. It's my whole life. It's every experience where someone looked at me and went, you are less than because of the color of your skin. It's every story that we told around the dinner table with my family where it said, oh, this happened. You're black, so if this happens, this is what you need to do. And I get that it's different than your white friends, but that's the reality of life. It's every time our group came together, the black community came together and told stories of our group and said, we are different. We have to protect ourselves. We cannot be the same as everybody else. It's every story or every experience of someone like me looking at someone like her and saying, your color of your skin means this about you. I was looking at it as the color of your skin. That's what black means. That's the experience I've coupled. She's taking this massive body of every experience that she's had, her family's had, her people have had, and all of that is coupled to that word in that moment. And Vince the jackass doesn't see it at all. If Malcolm Gladwell is right, if we couple things together, and that explains why Jesus loses his mind when they're selling stuff in the church parking lot. Something's coupled to that moment for him that enrages him to the point where he's no longer a pacifist. If that's the case, and if words have this weight of experiences coupled to them, how do we talk to strangers? Screw that. How do I talk to my wife? Right? We do it by being curious of what's underneath the words. What if I would have been at that dinner table and said, when I use that word, what experiences come up for you? What stories did you tell at the dinner table when you were a kid? What stories do people, when you get together with your black friends, what stories do they tell about the world around them? What if I would have asked those questions? Do you think we would have had a better conversation? It didn't end up in blows with me and her. It ended up in this kind of awkward, like, fading away. Right now, we're having some of the most difficult conversations of my generation. And what I see myself doing and I see others doing is we're looking at the words or we're applying our experiences to those words and we're not looking at other people's experiences that are coupled to those words. And so my encouragement today is this. What would happen if we brought curiosity to the experiences of the people around us and what they've coupled to that word? What do you think would happen if we did that to our partners, our kids, you know, Go make your room. Screw you. I told you to go make, you know. Wait, what's going on there? What does go make up your room mean to you? What's going on for you? What would the world look like? At Friend Church, we exist to make the world a better place. What would it look like if we could actually have conversations between people on difficult topics and actually hear each other? Actually get the experiences underneath the words. Do you think we would have more love in this world? Do you think we'd have more beautiful disagreements in this world? You know, when I build these messages, I work on them for months. And I collect all these ideas. And then at the end, I come up with this final idea, but I sometimes forget where the ideas came from. Last week, as I'm sitting in this service, Alessandra plays this song that she'd sent me the lyrics to a couple weeks ago. And I was like, oh, that's where my message came from. So I thought to close this, I want to let her describe what I'm trying to say today and let you guys experience it in a much more beautiful and poetic way than I can do.